Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
This is a CBC Podcast.
Hi, everyone. This is Other People's Problems, and I'm Hillary McBride. A couple weeks ago, we released a bonus episode from my client, Louise. She was hospitalized because of anorexia and caught COVID while in the hospital. When we last talked from that hospital room, she'd been in quarantine for weeks. And we released the episode as a bonus because the audio is really poor quality. But we knew the issue of eating disorders matters to lots of you, and Louise's honesty about her struggle was remarkable. Now, it's been a few weeks and Louise is recovering. She's actually back at home, living with her mom and dad. The audio in this session still isn't that much better, but I hope that you take a lot of joy in hearing how much determination Louise has to live life in this session that she and I recorded over Zoom. And for this one, it's best if you can listen on headphones in a quiet place.
Yeah, so I'm back home.
How does it feel to be back?
I mean, under the circumstances that I was under, it feels amazing to be back.
Yeah,
see my family, it's good too, and it's been good because I've kind of kept separate from them a little bit.
Okay.
Just because I've just taken time away when I need it, whereas before coming back home, it was always like me, especially me and my mom, becoming like entangled, and then everything would just go downhill.
Mm-hmm.
So like if she's having a bad day, I'm really trying to be cognizant of the fact that that could bring me down. So I've been, you know, aware of that and like being like, no, it's okay to do my own thing.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's a really big deal for me because
I was going to say,
I usually don't give myself permission to do anything. Anything.
Yeah. For you.
For me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go outside and enjoy our front, you know, we've got a nice like deck and a fountain thing. I'm going to go enjoy that. Outside, like I can go and just do that, and I don't have to like check in with my mom. And I know that sounds weird that like I would check in with my mom about that, but like I don't know, I think that's just how I've always been, and it feels weird to not always be checking in with her.
To be making some choices for yourself about your life and what you want.
Yeah.
Even in these little ways to start.
Mm-hmm.
When I listen to what Louise is saying here, one of the things that comes to mind is how difficult it's been for her in her life to use her own voice. There's been so much fear for her around making choices or stepping into agency. And so Louise is trying to negotiate, where does she end and where do other people begin? Where do other people end and where does she begin? And negotiating boundaries, which doesn't mean just saying no to other people, but also means what am I responsible for? What can I say yes to in my life? She's wanting to step into more responsibility for her own life, to take some of the power away from the eating disorder. And that might mean changing the way that she relates to other people, especially people with whom she shares a home.
How do you think that happened? I mean, I noticed it was a big deal. You said it was a big deal. How'd you get here?
I think it's like, she is a caregiver for my dad.
Mm-hmm.
So like her time is spent a lot with him. mm-hmm. just by virtue of her not being as present to me, and kind of noticing patterns of how she really triggers my eating disorder. Her responses to things really triggers my eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Not wanting to have to go back to hospital,
mm-hmm.
so fighting hard to
mm-hmm.
stay home and get myself out of that cycle. It's taking a lot of courage and a lot of inner strength to say, no, I'm doing really well right now, actually, like coming home. At first 2 days, I was like bombing, and then I was like, no, I don't want this. I don't want to go back.
Whoa.
Like, I know Whoa. What it is, and it'll just be 6 more weeks of more torture and more isolation. So I just literally turned it around. Like, I'm eating, you know, so much food and making all my meals. You know, my mom and I would be in the kitchen together, but like, and making the same meal, but like, I'll be involved in it, and it's fine. Like, I don't argue anything. Or like, if she's busy, without her permission, I go and I grab my snack and my lunch. So it's like, really, like, things that, yeah, I'd never do before.
Can I slow you down for a second there?
Yeah.
Whoa. I mean, what's happening in you telling me all of this?
I think I feel a bit excited and nervous.
Yeah.
I'm scared. But it's like, there is another side of me that is fighting back now that wasn't before. So
I can hear it and see it all over everything you're telling me.
Mm-hmm.
I had tears in my eyes when you were telling me about that. I'm just so moved to hear and see you come out from behind all of the ways the eating disorder had kept who you are tucked away.
Yeah, I think like eating disorders are an illness, 100%. But it's also like a part, like a character almost you play. And I know how that works, and I know how it would work in the setting of a hospital and treatment, and how I respond to treatment in hospital, and I've done it so many times, and I just want to feel alive and like
wow.
Find out who I am. Like, I don't really know, to be honest. She's been you know, kind of shoved down by eating disorder for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mm-hmm. really know, but I know that she's in there more, mm-hmm. and you want to explore that, and treatment kind of stops that way. being, you know, and you're dealing with other people's eating disorders too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've just done that for so long. I'm just really not interested in that.
Sounds like you're so ready for something different.
When somebody has been struggling with an eating disorder for so long and their life has oriented around the disorder and the treatment of the disorder, it's actually really hard to remember parts of yourself that aren't related to the eating disorder. What is it like to adventure and try new things? Who is she in social situations? What kind of food does she actually like? I mean, all of these things get eclipsed when the eating disorder and eating disorder treatment are the main focus in her life. And so when she's talking about this role that she plays, she's not really talking about the fact that it's like fake or that it isn't a real issue. We're more talking about this part of herself, that is preoccupied with food restriction, this part of herself that is the eating disorder. It's like she's been sat on by the eating disorder and she's trying to wiggle her way out from underneath it. And there's a lot of fear in that, because playing this role of being in the eating disorder comes with clear guidelines. a way of eating, a way of people understanding who she is. And she's ready for something more. You hear it in her voice that she wants to be alive. And that means remembering who she is when she's not in the eating disorder part of herself.
Yeah, it's scary and it's hard and like the eating disorder is loud. Like it's not like okay. It's like I like last night I was like eating dinner, like literally like shaking my whole body, shaking. But you know, I did it still. But like
wow,
yeah, it's hard.
I'm just over here in awe of all of your hard work of getting to see you come out from behind the eating disorder. I mean, I feel kind of speechless, honestly. Like it's so much has shifted from when we talked last.
Yeah.
Like, can you just stay connected to what I'm sharing with you for a moment? What is it like for you to know my speechlessness here? It's cool. Tell me what's cool about it.
I don't know. Just it feels like validating, I guess, too, and kind of came to a point where I felt like my brain was frying. Like,
yeah,
I could feel myself losing it completely, and I thought, if I don't fight back now on my own, I'm gonna forever be like treatment out.
Uh-huh.
And my eating disorder is going to be my life. And because I could feel my brain, like literally from like the illness, I think like physiologically as well, like I could literally feel my brain going and that scared me a lot.
I think when Louise is talking about her brain frying, she's referencing the fact that she feels like there's a part of herself that is slipping away, and she's aware that she might not get it back if she doesn't take really intentional steps to do recovery differently than she's done it before. Malnutrition and starving, which is essentially what happens in cases of anorexia, has a huge cost on the actual anatomical structure of the brain. In fact, there are even some cases of anorexia causing brain damage. Now, some of the changes can be repaired when weight is restored, but some other changes can't be repaired, and it seems like they have a lasting impact on the function and structure of the brain. But whenever our brain doesn't get the nutrients it needs, because it is an organ, that organ begins to deteriorate, and this can impact cognitive functioning, the way that we think about ourselves and the world, the speed at which we process, and how we skew our interpretation of the things that are happening around us.
I'm remembering our conversation from a couple of weeks ago where you had said it feels like there's the me on the inside is gone.
Yeah.
And there's just 1 or 2% of me left, and the rest, the 98-99%, is the eating disorder taken over.
Mm-hmm.
And you had said that you had felt so much hope seeing that knowing that I could see that 2% of you that was still in there, because you couldn't see that in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then fast forward a few weeks and here we are, and your voice, your sense of self sounds clearer and stronger, more determined, fiercer than I think I've ever heard you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look at what you've done.
Yeah, and I feel that way too.
Wow.
But you know, my parents don't, and they're still pretty certain I need to go back, and I will go back.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the midst of negotiating with them. You know, I feel like I always have to prove how well I'm doing, so I don't have to go back, I guess.
Yeah. I hear you right, when you say that they probably don't trust you so much right now,
mm-hmm.
and that you have to prove a lot. But what sounds really different right now is that there is wanting to prove to them that you're okay, but you wanting that for you, I just hear your voice. I hear your sense of determination and this not just be about avoiding treatment, but about wanting your life to start and wanting to figure out more of who you are. And it's so different to try to like work through all these hard things just to avoid treatment than it is to work through all these hard things because you actually want your life to begin.
Yeah. After treatment, usually I have like a plan, like I go back home and I'll jump into this university course or this job or this. But right now, I mean, it's kind of helped by like quarantine time, but I've like taken all pressure off myself to do or be anything and not just like try to like shove down all the pain and everything. And the body image, like I've started like a body image workbook and like ordered another book or two, but like even I was on the phone with my caseworker and she's like, you better come or, you know, you don't want to put this off. And I get that. I get there's a high relapse rate for me.
When I hear Louise talking about the threat of relapse and how other professionals in her life are concerned about the risk of relapse, I'm aware of the research that shows that relapse is often actually a part of recovery. That is one of the stages of change, that there are different ways that we move forward, taking steps forward towards recovery and taking steps backwards, and that all of that is part of the cycle. But I think that she's worried enough about relapse for the both of us, for everybody. She has lots of people in her life telling her about what she's doing wrong and how she needs to be afraid. And what she needs to experience in our dynamic is something different. Because what happens when we try to reinforce how afraid we are of somebody else's relapse is we make the experience about us and we put so much pressure on them without realizing how much that pressure, that interpersonal stress, actually contributes to the rate of relapse itself. What we need when we're trying to heal, whether it's from eating disorders or addiction or depression or anxiety or any of the presenting concerns that bring us into therapy, what we need is the space to feel like we can breathe. We need the space to remember who we are when we haven't so over-identified with the struggle that we've lost the ways of being that will get us out of the struggle itself.
What if someone you love asks you to help them die? What would you say? This is the powerful question at the heart of The Ultimate Choice. The series follows the journey of Michael and his wife Anne as they grapple with his request to choose the way he wants to die. I'm Rob Cribb, and through their story, I learned a lot about my own family. I hope the show is a way to start conversations many of us want to have, but rarely do. The Ultimate Choice is out now.
When you say it feels different than ever before, can you tell me a little bit more about that difference? Like what's here that hasn't been here before?
I told my parents, like, I want a small life. And like, once I said that, I felt some freedom just to be.
When you say small life, you mean like keeping the expectations reasonable and...
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Not physically anymore.
Yeah, but the things you expect of yourself, the way perhaps the number of things you're involved in right now, keeping it focused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I'm really hearing a very clear wanting come through in you.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting is a kind of existential appetite, so mm-hmm. to speak. I haven't heard your wanting so clear before. I'm wondering what it's like for you to want life, to want boundaries, to want to heal, to know what feels right, and to be able to trust that.
New and exciting and scary and terrifying, actually.
Mm-hmm. tell me a little bit about that fear that comes up around wanting a triad life.
I mean, there's a fear that I will fail. I won't be able to do it. I haven't done or experienced much of adult life. I don't know. When I was little, I was an old soul and too mature for my age. And now that I'm an adult, I'm like too immature and naive for my age. And so I just never fit.
There's always been some mismatch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand what it feels like to feel young and feel scared and feel small. And yet I think you have always been dealing with such big questions of life.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, you are doing some very, very adult things. And yet perhaps you have not been given the resources or the scaffolding to be able to ask the questions in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming for you.
Yeah.
I experience you today as being very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what it feels like to hear me say that in light of what you are describing as a sense of fear.
Well, I've always feared my power. I feared losing it. I feared having it. I feared, I guess, what the price of that has been.
Mm-hmm.
Quieting and self-destruction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, today it doesn't scare me quite as much because I think I have found a little bit more of my own inner voice.
Can we go back to this for just a moment?
Mm-hmm.
What is it like for you to hear me tell you that I experience you as powerful? That looks a little more uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, I've been told I'm very... In my eating disorder, I'm definitely powerful. I'm definitely master negotiator. That I know, like, I'm afraid for you to say that about me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, when I was in school, if I got, like, an A, I told my mom, she'd be like, oh, that's so amazing, good job. And I would want to downplay it. Because that meant next time I'd have to get an A. I'm always trying to like downplay and kind of like use all the back doors to kind of.
One of the key features of individuals who struggle with anorexia is the inability to experience pleasure or to stay with an experience that's pleasurable or satisfying. When there is positive feedback for her, there is, it seems, this automatic response that wants to shield her from that because it comes with this kind of this pressure. If I'm being celebrated, if I'm being affirmed, then somehow that means that I have to be good and perfect forever for everybody. If we're looking for it, you can see a kind of protective mechanism happening here. That if she believes that the praise comes with pressure, look at how she is taking care of herself to keep herself from feeling even more pressure. The catch is that there is a kind of double bind there, then she never gets to see herself the way that other people see her. And she doesn't get to take in and really believe those things to be true about herself in a way that would scaffold her to be able to do more difficult things in her life.
And what would happen if you didn't downplay and you allowed yourself to experience yourself through my eyes?
I think I feel very, very vulnerable.
Yeah, I noticed that when I said to you first, I experience you as being powerful, you didn't respond to me directly. You ended up telling me about, okay, so power over here, and I think power, and this is my analysis of this. And it seemed hard to stay in that connection moment of me sharing my perspective.
Yeah.
Staying connected to me, and that was hard. And this is just a curiosity. You can tell me if it resonates or not. If that feeling might just say, actually, when we get right down to the bottom of it, I'm not used to this, and I don't know how to do this.
Yeah, I actually used that the other day. I think you told me that. So, when it feels wrong, like to eat something or to like do something, it's not wrong. It's just change your feeling. So I've actually been using that a lot. You know, getting to sit on my deck with coffee and a breakfast in the morning. Like, I've never let myself do that. Or today, it was raining outside, so I sat on my bed and had breakfast, and I never let myself do that. And it feels so wrong, like a big itch. That's just this giant itch. You have to move and do my XYZ morning routine. But then I was like, well, it's not wrong to do this. And like my head was telling me it was self-indulgent. I was like, it's just a change, and people do it all the time.
And did that make it a bit more tolerable then?
Yeah.
Okay. That's incredible, by the way. Wow. The fact that you remembered that and were able to talk yourself through that in such a kind and gentle way. I'm really struck by that.
Look back at my notes.
Good for you. Well, way to go for taking those notes and for remembering to use them. Mm-hmm. And so let's try this again. If and when you notice that discomfort in your chest dries up, perhaps just saying to yourself on the inside, oh, that's just uncomfortable. That's just an uncomfortable feeling because this is new and I'm not used to it and I'm changing. So I'm just going to be here thinking about how much I treasure you. You can take in. Oh, there. Okay, good. So stay with that. Good. We got it activated. So notice that discomfort and do your thing on the inside with that. Now, is that going? What's happening?
That was interesting. Sorry, I'm like horrible.
You're not horrible. You're not horrible. I want to see what came up for you. You tell me.
So I went through, this feels uncomfortable.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, it's just change.
Yeah.
It's just something different. You're not used to people like genuinely spending time with you like this. And then I went to panic.
Okay.
So because then that brought the social aspect in. Because I'm like, somebody's staring at me. I'm going to have to make the right response. Like, what do I say? Because if this is quiet time, someone's staring at me, I don't know what to say or do.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And that's where it ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just learned so much about you. I just learned so much about what happens inside and why connecting to other people is probably so hard. Comes with all that pressure and the feeling like you have to say the exact right thing next.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how it feels to hear me say this. I'd like to know how it feels to hear me say this. That is something we can totally work on.
Okay.
Yeah, that is like, yeah. You're in the right place. That is, we can work on that. We can change. You can feel some relief from that pressure and that expectation has to be the next right thing and the perfect thing.
What we forget about socializing is that it's a skill, right? Even think about the language we use, social skills, that there are things that we have to practice. But perfectionism gets in the way of taking those social risks, which ultimately also have rewards like connection and satisfaction and a sense of being a part of a community. And to be able to do that, we have to learn how to tolerate the discomfort of fear and risk. Louise has so much difficulty tolerating anxiety. And really, so many experiences and emotions for her feel uncomfortable and overwhelming. And she doesn't yet have the skills to tolerate those feelings, to trust herself so that she could end up taking the risks that would get to the place where she would feel connected to other people. And we can work on it together. In fact, we're doing it every time we have a session. We're practicing the back and forth of conversation, the risk of letting somebody in. We're practicing relationship every session we have. It's obvious to me in listening to her that fear is in the room with us. It's getting in the way of her feeling like she could actually connect with the hope that's also there. And so because fear is with us, I figured why not just address it directly? It's obviously in the room. Let's have a conversation with it and see what happens next.
And I'm curious if you imagined the fear show up in front of you or was in the room with you there, what the fear would look like, what kind of shape or symbol or persona the fear takes on.
It's like a really big ball and it's bouncing off the walls.
Yeah.
All over.
Okay.
Whoa. All over constantly.
Okay. No wonder. That sounds really overwhelming and distracting and, like it would take a lot of energy to focus if that was going on.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you imagine saying to this big ball, thank you for bringing to my attention some of the stuff I need to keep an eye on? And then can you say, and I think I might be able to hear you better if you were able to slow down a bit and give me some more space. And I'm not going to make you go away because you're there for a reason. And what's happening to the fear right now?
It's come off the walls, just on the ground now. Mm-hmm. Just bumping up my feet, kind of.
Mm-hmm. What is that like, that it's not on the walls and it's just bumping against your feet now?
It's a lot of relief.
Yeah.
Space.
And when there's some space from it, what happens?
Yeah, I can breathe a little better.
Yeah. You're allowed to say, I see you, fear. I know you're here. I know you have something important to say. And can you bring it down a notch so we could actually have a conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Now you have somewhere deep inside of you this journalist streak. And I am wondering if for a piece of homework between now and when I see you next,
mm-hmm.
if you could interview the fear.
Okay. Around what? Like just generally or around something specific?
Just, yeah, maybe being home, life in this next season, for you, maybe even in this next year. What is it trying to tell you is scary? What does it want you to know? What would need to happen for it to be able to release even just a bit more?
Okay.
Yeah. And I'll ask you about that when I see you next.
You're witnessing therapeutic transformation. I didn't give her a medication. I didn't wave a magic wand. We actually moved towards the fear and it shifted. Like these are the moments that totally blow my mind in therapy where we get to see something that has been plaguing someone all of a sudden fall to the ground. Like that image she gives us is just, it's exhilarating to hear. The eating disorder has acted as this kind of blanket covering all of the difficult feelings in her life and making them go away by giving her this other singular focus. And as she's learning to rebuild her life to move away from the anorexia, she's getting this really good information that moving towards feelings is not only tolerable, but it's effective. It's so normal for us to have fear when we do something new. And Louise wants to do life differently than she has before. And stepping into responsibility for life means that there is fear and risk of failure, making mistakes, the weight of self-ownership, and being an adult in her own life. I often think with Louise that this must be like moving to a new country where she doesn't speak the language. And it's terrifying to learn all of these things from the bottom up, how to eat, how to think, how to be in relationships. And if Louise and I can make friends with the fear, then the fear doesn't have to be this thing that stops her from moving into this new phase of her life. It can be something that keeps her eyes open to risk and danger, but accompanies her as she starts to tell a new story about who she is in the world. I'm Hillary McBride. Other People's Problems is produced by Jody Martinson, mixed by Will Howie. TK Matunda is our associate producer. Fabiola Carletti is our digital producer. Tanya Springer is our senior producer. RF Narani is the executive producer of CBC Podcasts.
For more CBC Podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.